From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. With its sleek bullet trains, its world-beating electronics, and its tech-loving population, Japan has long had the reputation as a society of the future. But Japan is also providing a glimpse of the future in another way. Its population has begun to decline, and that decline is expected to accelerate. The native-born Japanese population fell by 430,000 people last year. By one estimate, its overall population will fall from 126 million today to below 100 million in just 30 years. This means Japan is also getting older and older. Already about 28% of the population is 65 or above. That's about double the rate in the U.S. But Japan isn't alone. South Korea is facing a similar problem. Their life expectancy has increased rapidly at the same time that birth rates have cratered. So this has left the country on the edge of a demographic cliff. Now, of course, the same challenges are going to be faced to varying degrees here in the U.S., in Europe, and elsewhere. So on this edition of Global Journalist, a look at Japan and South Korea's rapidly aging societies and what their challenges can tell us about our own futures. We've got a great panel of guests who will join us in a few minutes. First, we'll bring in Robin Harding in Tokyo. He's the Tokyo Bureau Chief for the Financial Times, and he wrote about this recently. Robin, welcome.
Hi there.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. Tell us, if you would, when you get off the plane in Japan as someone visiting the country, is it noticeable that the population looks different than it does in the U.S. or in other countries?
Well, you won't notice it when you get off the plane. In fact, you'll be shocked if you go to the center of Tokyo. You'll think, what's all this aging thing I heard about? Because all the young people are in the center of Tokyo. But if you go to the countryside in Japan, you really will notice it. Because there are whole towns and villages in Japan where virtually everybody now is over the age of 60 or 70, and whole shopping streets which are called shutter streets, shatadori, because every shop has its shutter down and never opens. And everyone you pass is, you know, got a walking stick or something. So certainly if you want to see it, go to rural Japan.
Well, remind us why Japan's population is declining and why that decline is accelerating.
Well, so it's two basic things. On one side, Japan had a baby boom in the 1930s, pre-war, because of pressure from the military government to have more children. And then post-war, like every other country, when people came back. So those people, those generations are starting to pass away. And it's that increase in the death rate which is causing the decline in the population to really pick up. But the other factor is that birth rates have been very low in Japan since the 1970s. So it's basically been 50 years now of birth rates below the replacement level. You put those two things together, you get population decline, which is going to get faster and faster. So it's now about the sort of a mid-sized city every year. Within about 20 or 30 years, it's going to be almost a million people a year that Japan's losing.
So like a mid-sized city per year is effectively disappearing from Japan. But we'll talk to us a little bit about this low birth rate. I mean, I think people can understand why there was a baby boom around World War II. But why are birth rates so low in Japan? You mentioned the replacement level. That's, I think it's 2.1 children per woman.
Yeah, so I mean, it's a very complicated question, but there's I think the single biggest thing is the position of women in society. So certainly traditionally in Japan, women had to quit their job when they had a child. And come the 1960s, the 1970s, women decided they didn't want that. They didn't want to be stay-at-home mothers and housewives. They wanted to have careers, but that just wasn't compatible with having a family in Japan then. So it's changed a bit.
Well, why not? Why isn't it compatible with having a family?
Well, so that was sort of cultural attitudes. There was an expectation that women would stop working if they had a child. It's changed somewhat. But for example, one woman I interviewed, who's a very high-flying professional woman at a big company, she said, you know, she could have one children. She could take one maternity leave and be absent from the workplace. But she didn't feel she could have two. It just couldn't be done. And there's a lot of factors that go into it, like long commuting times, absence of childcare, long working hours in Japan, the sort of pressure to show total loyalty to the company. It's a complex picture, but what it adds up to is it's still in Japan very hard to combine professional life with family life.
Well, I understand that this shift towards having sort of a very large elderly population is causing some stresses in society, some tension between the younger people and the elderly. Talk to us about that.
Well, I think it makes sense. It's what you'd expect when you have such a huge number of elderly people and now quite a small number of younger people in a society which is influenced by Confucian ideals, which say you should respect the old. But now there's so many old expecting respect from a small number of young people. And the tensions it leads to are more a sort of sullen resentment among younger Japanese. So, for example, there's a genre of videos on YouTube called Logai videos, which are basically stupid old people videos. You can look them up, R-O-U-G-A-I. And they're basically videos of old people behaving in annoying and selfish ways, driving badly, blocking the escalator. It's small things like that, but that level of irritation, that sense among young Japanese that they're put upon by this huge elderly population is really growing, and I think it's just going to grow more and more.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this even plays out in Japanese politics, too. We see the Japanese government, I understand, has been trying to raise sales tax for a number of years, in part to pay for the cost of having such a large elderly population.
Yeah, so I think this is another way that young Japanese feel put upon. So the tax burden in Japan goes up and up and up, and most of that is to pay for social security and healthcare for the elderly. So if you're young, you know, if you're in your 20s starting work, then the prospect that lies ahead of you is 50 years of hard work and steadily increasing taxes, none of which you're going to directly see the benefit of yourself. And then you're just going to have to hope that the pension system is still there when you eventually retire. So you can see why people feel a bit irked at that prospect.
Well, I understand that one other consequence of this demographic change is that there have actually been sort of higher rates of crime among the elderly. Talk to us about that.
Well, that's a really interesting one. It's a little bit hard to interpret, but certainly the statistics say there are higher rates of crime amongst the elderly. A big part of that is sort of crime in nursing homes and old people's homes. And you can imagine it. People are cooped up all day in these old people's homes. They get really sick of each other and they take a slug at someone and, you know, knock out old Mr. Suzuki or something who keeps changing the TV channel. So that's part of it. So the older generation like to say it's because they're more earthy. They have more spirit. They went through tough times, and so they're much more likely to commit a crime than the milksop younger Japanese who've had it easy and wouldn't ever go and rob a bank or something. But it's definitely there in the statistics.
Well, our time grows short, Robin, but I want to ask you, what about immigration? I mean, is Japan looking at just taking more workers, more people from other countries? I mean, it's a very wealthy economy.
So, given the birth rate's been low for 50 years, there's basically no way that you can turn this around through an increase in the Japanese population. So if you want to avoid a population decline, basically the only option is large-scale immigration. But Japan's a very homogenous country. It always has been. There's no large non-ethnic Japanese populations in the country. So there's now a very heated debate going on about whether Japan will be willing to accept higher levels of immigration in the future. And where it's got to so far is the country's willing to accept guest workers, people who come for a few years and do a job that Japanese people don't want. But so far, the country hasn't been willing to consider permanent immigration. So that's really the debate that's going on now, and I think the debate that's going to continue for the next decade or two.
Well, Robin Harding, thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
My pleasure.
This is Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking about the rapidly aging societies of Japan and South Korea and what those countries' experiences may teach us as the U.S. and other nations age. Now, we just spoke with the Financial Times' Robin Harding in Tokyo. For more on this, we're going to bring in three other folks who have been following this issue closely. Joining us from Tokyo is Brad Glosserman. He's a senior advisor at the Pacific Forum and deputy director of the Tama University Center for Rulemaking Strategies, a Japanese think tank. He's also the author of a new book called Peak Japan, The End of Great Ambitions. Brad, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us in Seoul, South Korea, is Sung Jae Choi. He's professor emeritus in the Department of Social Welfare at Seoul National University. Sung Jae, welcome.
Well, thank you.
And on the line from Oxford, England, is George Leeson. He's a senior research fellow and director of the Oxford Institute of Population Aging at the University of Oxford. George, welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
Well, it's a pleasure to have all of you. Let me start with you, Brad Glosserman. We just heard from Robin Harding about all these different stresses in Japanese society. Obviously, these changes didn't happen overnight, and Japan has been growing old for some time. How well prepared was its government for this big demographic bust?
It's not very well prepared at all. That's what's quite remarkable about the country, is that if you actually go back, the Japanese have been predicting a demographic problem since the 1970s. And the fact that they have yet to make the substantive changes and adjustments to their society, their economy, their political system that would, you know, change the trends is what suggests, is what to me is what's so incredible. And it speaks, I think, very much to Robin's point about it being an incredibly conservative culture. Very simply, there are very fixed ideas about the role of women in Japan, and the Japanese have very little inclination to change those.
Well, Sungjae Choi, if I could bring you in, we talked about South Korea and its rapidly changing demographics. I guess the biggest factor in that is that South Korea's birth rate has dropped precipitously over the last 50 years. What's happened?
Yes, as of last year, 2018, the total fertility rate, that is birth rate, was 0.98. This figure would
so I'm
be
sorry, less than of, less than one child per woman in her lifetime, then, is the fertility rate.
Less than one child, right, yes. And the main reason of that is throughout the Korean history for the past 40 or 50 years, we have very successful birth control. Another word is family planning. It was very successful. And until the 1990s, the birth control planning and family planning has been prevailing in Korean society. And turning into the 21st century, and the birth rate was dropped to almost 1.5. From then on, but for the past 20 years, and the birth rate was dropped to less than one. And the other one is the reason for the decreasing birth rate is the very difficult of child care and education. And this is the one of the main reasons for the decreasing.
So the high cost, the high cost of child care, the difficulties in, sure, in getting a good education, sure, yeah, for your child, as well as the availability of birth control, women entering the workforce. So it sounds like the causes there are the same as in Japan and in other places. But if, George Leeson, if I could turn this to you then, we often talk about declining populations or aging populations as if they're a bad thing, as if they're a problem to be solved. You don't necessarily see things that way.
No. I think listening to the discussion we're having now, I think we have to ask, what is it for an issue that we're really looking at here? Is it because there are too many old people? Is it because we're living too long? Well, surely that is a success. Or is it because fundamentally younger people have changed their attitudes to having children? And in fact, it's a combination of both. And any given demographic as such doesn't have to be a problem. And I think what we're also listening to is that it's the infrastructures in societies which create the problems, not the demographics.
What do you mean by that?
Well, so for example, behind a statistic of increasing longevity and more of us living longer and healthier lives, behind that is the fact that we live in societies that continue to insist on retiring people probably in their 60s, when they have a life expectancy which, as we move through the 21st century, is going to get longer and longer, 30, 40, who knows how many years. These people are active and healthy and actually should and want to be contributing to society. They don't want to be a burden. They don't want to be seen as a burden. But our infrastructures don't accommodate them. Workplaces don't accommodate them. Workplaces, everything in our societies were designed for a young population. And as we've heard very clearly, we don't have young populations there is no sign on the horizon that we will return to young populations in our lifetimes.
Well, Brad Glosserman, if I could bring you back in, I mean, it does seem like this will be a problem for Japan economically. I mean, how does this changing population demographic, how is it affecting Japan's pocketbook and its economic power?
Well, it's profound. And I mean, George makes a great point. I mean, their value judgments, they're just embedded in all of these assumptions we're making about the ideal demographic structure. You know, it's interesting that the news today is that the Japanese government now is encouraging companies and urging them to push the retirement age back to 70, precisely to cap and to utilize the ability, you know, to tap this reservoir of experience and age and of potential income contributors. You know, it is precisely the fact that our political systems and our political economies are structured essentially for young people. But, I mean, there are profound consequences. Older societies are just not quite as dynamic. Young people are more innovative, they're more entrepreneurial, they're more inclined to take risks. As you get older, and particularly as you diminish the number of young people, you end up with just being less able to do certain things, to generate certain types of ideas and experiences, and consequently, your society is going to change profoundly.
And how do you see that playing out in Japan right now, Brad? Is that in evidence?
Well, it's the title of my book. I mean, I think it's very much a function of the fact that this is a society that is going to face profound financial problems. Japan is already the most indebted industrial country in the world, or industrial society, with about 240-280% of debt to GDP, depending on whose estimates you use. And then you have to pay for that. And then you're going to have to be able to generate additional economic activity again among a shrinking workforce, and one that is far less inclined to take risks, to be energetic, to be innovative. And so, you know, the notion that the Japanese are, to my mind, there are ways to adapt that would allow Japan to be a model in some ways, not in many, or all. But the Japanese are going to have to change their notion of what leadership is, what their role in the world is going to be, precisely because they're not going to have the resources to devote to many of the endeavors that we have, you know, in the West, for example, have valued as signs of leadership.
Well, let me turn this then to Sungjae Choi, because we heard Brad and George talking about this issue of retirement and the retirement age. I understand that in South Korea, life expectancy, at least for women, may hit 90 years old. So the average woman born will live to be 90. Obviously, if people are retiring early, that's a long time that they have to have their retirement paid for. How does that play out in South Korea?
Yes, currently, mandatory retirement age for public and the private sectors is 60. And this was adjusted 2 years ago. And until 2 years ago, the retirement age for the private sectors was not governed by the public laws. It was cases was left to the private organization itself, but it is fortunate then that we have the public law to keep the retirement age at age 60, just only 2 years. And I think the retirement age in Korea is 60 is too low compared to other industrialized country. But Japanese society has already set up 65 at the retirement age, and then other measures of complementing the retirement age 65.
Sure, because if you're talking about mandatory retirement at age 60 and a life expectancy on average of 90, we're talking about, a lot of people, 35 years in retirement. So it seems like it makes sense for people to be working longer. But George Leeson, if I could turn this to you, I mean, I think one of the big questions about these aging societies is sort of how we can care for all these elderly people. And I understand that one of the projects you're working on with some Japanese researchers is a project to develop therapeutic robots for the elderly. Talk to us about that.
The therapeutic robots already exist, and we are looking in our research at how these can improve the quality of life and well-being of older people. I think the scope in modern societies for the use of technologies, including robots, is massive. The potential, I think, is huge as we get our heads around what they can and cannot help us with. But if I may, can I just say that, you know, the fact that we're getting more and more older people, we shouldn't misunderstand that and assume that that means there are going to be more and more older people who need help, because we are living longer lives, yes, but a large proportion of those longer lives are still very healthy and active. And as we see improvements in medical technologies, for example, stem cell therapy and genetic manipulation, I think the potential for long, healthy lives is yet to be totally realized. And 90 years on average, yes, but let me just say that here in the UK, the generation of girls being born at the moment are predicted to have a life expectancy of 103 years. So it's even more dramatic than we think it might be.
A reminder that you're tuned into Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's program, we're talking about the rapidly aging countries of Japan and South Korea and the challenges this poses for each society, both economically and socially. And Brad Glosserman, I mentioned earlier that obviously this isn't a problem just faced by Japan and South Korea. A number of other countries all around the world, especially in Western Europe in particular, are going to face these big demographic changes here. What are some lessons that these other countries, including the U.S., can take away from the experiences of Japan or from South Korea?
I would mention that, you know, in addition to the Western European countries, one of the ones that's a country that's going to be really facing these problems in an intense way is China. China is going to be the first country that's going to get old before it gets rich, and that's going to pose some just phenomenal sets of problems. And that's more than a program all by itself. I suppose for the Japanese, the lessons would be that you've got to really make the commitment to serious policy changes. You've got to look at ways that you can encourage, you know, to get to attitudinal issues that really go to the heart of constraints on population and demographic change. So, you know, you need to provide for childcare. You need to provide for change tax structure so that second incomes are encouraged. Women are not given a penalty for doing real work, even if on a part-time level. You want to encourage women to stay in the workforce. You want to come up with just a whole variety of means that address the attitudinal constraints that essentially rob people of the desire to have additional children. You need to open your borders in ways that bring in skilled and workers that will help fill the gaps. The Japanese, I think, as Robin mentioned, are a little bit of a problem in terms of giving, you know, providing good examples, because their society is so homogenous in many ways. In the West, the United States, Canada, Australia, Western Europeans, you know, they have more open borders, and as a result, they're more inclined to take in foreigners, and that proves to be a very important pressure valve, or release, if you will, for some of those pressures.
And Sung Jae Choi, if I could ask you about attitudes among the elderly in Korea. As we mentioned, that this group of elderly is growing very rapidly in South Korea, and really this generation is getting pinched, because as I understand it, when they were younger, they were the last generation of workers to take care of their own parents, and now as they are hitting retirement age, their children are saying, no, we don't want to take care of you, we want the state to take care of you. And I understand that there's a lot of unhappiness and resentment about that. Can you talk to us about it?
Yes, recently the trend of the young persons and the younger children don't like to take care of their aging parents, but not so serious right now, but it's becoming in the future. But for the past 10 years, and the Korean society have institutionalized long-term care public insurance, and it has been 10 years. But because of that, most of the elderly people are cared well at home, or sometimes they are institutionalized at a nursing home, but still it is good. But in the future, it will be very difficult, and because of the public insurance system cannot take care of all the expenses for the taking care of the elderly parent at home or institutional situation. And one of the main reason is that is the, in generally is ageism. Maybe the public knows that what is ageism.
Ageism is discrimination against older people, older workers.
That discrimination is older people. This is very serious in Korean society for the past several decades. And in Korean society, ageism has deeply and widely permeated all the society, particularly to younger generation.
Well, this must make it difficult when you're talking about raising the mandatory retirement age from 60. Like, you have to change attitudes culturally because companies, they don't want to hire people over 60, it sounds like.
Yeah, this is related. The ageism itself is related to this, is impacting on the, you know, the raising the mandatory retirement age over 60. But unless we dismantle or improve the ageism, the Korean and aging society will meet a very serious problem in 10 or in after that. And I'm personally very worried about this kind of,
I'm sorry, Soonjai, we have to move on because we have just a little bit of time left. But George Leeson, I wanted to go to you because I understand that you've worked on this very large survey of global attitudes about aging that sort of measures what people think about the issue all around the world. What are some of the takeaway findings from this survey?
Well, we've looked in over 20 countries and about 40,000 people. And looking at people who are approaching retirement, they are anticipating having an active retirement. They would like to continue contributing to society, and they hope that society will enable them to do that. If I may, can I just say one thing around the low levels of childbearing? We live at a time when the world is faced with climate change, with massive use and deterioration of resources. The fact that families around the world are having fewer children is giving us a bit of a breathing space to tackle some of these big problems. It seems rather strange to me that governments would want to be encouraging people to have more children. And as Brad mentioned, maybe we should be opening up borders to younger workers from outside to be able to come in and keep those economies going that are struggling at the moment. And also the idea that not being able to have children and work is a big barrier to having more children. Just look at Scandinavia. Scandinavian has perfect childcare systems. That there's no reason for not having more and more children. They don't have very high levels of childbearing. We've seen a fundamental shift in people's attitudes, and I think we have to acknowledge that before we can move on.
Well, George, thanks so much for that. I'm sorry we're just out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA, Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Robin Harding, Brad Glosserman, Sungjae Choi, and George Leeson. Our assistant producers this week are Gail Fournier, Annie Lay, Connor O'Halloran, and we bid farewell to supervising producer Rosemary Belson, a supremely talented journalist who's leaving us to be a reporter in India. Aaron Hay is audio engineer. Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.